We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Marin Perez. Major Castanian, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Wright, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Samantha Castanian, and I, along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Ann Marin Perez, in today's case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sergeant Marin Perez did not knowingly and voluntarily plead guilty to the $21,300 larceny that the government charged. The Air Force Court agreed. But rather than setting aside the guilty plea, the Air Force Court affirmed, exceeding its statutory authority and contravening this court's case law. Because there is no lesser included offense to affirm and no way to narrow this specification that is consistent with care, this court should set aside the findings and the sentence. The Air Force Court's four-sentence analysis demonstrates how the Air Force Court misunderstood and exceeded its authority in this case. The Air Force Court starts out by saying, "We conclude that based on the record before us, we can affirm the finding of guilty to the specification by exceptions and substitutions." And that first sentence alone, we see the Air Force Court exceeding its authority by using a technical term of exceptions and substitutions. That term is a term of art from RCM 918, as this court stated in United States versus Lubasky and United States versus English.
May I ask you a little different question? Was, in fact, appellant provident to a larceny charge involving more than $1,000?
No, Your Honor, because there is some evidence in the record that indicates that the value of the property was or could have been under $1,000. And it's this.
Where do we find that? Because we've got the stipulation of fact where, regardless of the $21,300, was more than $1,000. We have the initial care inquiry where the appellant agreed that it was more than $1,000. We got the submission by the appraiser. We have the pawn shops paying more than $1,000. We have the reopened care inquiry. So where are you finding indication in the record here that the property was worth less than $1,000?
It's in the stipulation of fact, Your Honor, and the attachments for the pawn receipts, and that's going to be on pages 32 through 36 of the JA. What is listed there are 9 items that total up to $1,650, and that value could be one of the values that could have been considered if Sergeant Marin Perez was given the definition of value, which goes ultimately to Your Honor's question about the plea not being provident on any value whatsoever, but specifically to the question about there being evidence in the record about of under $1,000. Those 9 items are not itemized by their value, so we don't know how much each of those pieces of jewelry were sold for at the pawn shop, and there is some indication
but
that
the pawn shop indicated in total that it was more than $1,000.
That's for the 9 items, Your Honor, yes, but she only pled guilty to 6 of those items, and we don't have that breakdown for each one of those items to know what they were worth at the time she sold them.
So that's the only thing you can point to is the pawn shop. What about the stipulation of fact, the care inquiry, the submission by the appraiser, and so forth?
They're all conflicting, Your Honor. What's clear on this record?
Well, are they conflicting in terms of the precise amount, or are they conflicting in terms of whether it's worth more than $1,000?
Both, Your Honor. The ones that you have just listed, though, are consistent with being over $1,000. But there is still evidence in the record that the value of the property could have been under $1,000. And the crux of the prejudice here at the trial level, or what the Air Force Court was looking at, is that she didn't know what value meant in this case. This is not a simple case of value like in United States versus Barton, where it only had to be over $100, and that appellant was advised on the elements in that case. Here, Sergeant Marin Perez's value that was charged is different. The value here indicated what exactly the items she had to plead guilty to. Those 6 items that she pled guilty to are only identifiable in this case because of the $21,000 value listed in the charge.
So, counsel, I think this is a follow-on to the chief's question, because as you're arguing, I'm sitting here thinking, if the values were so unknown, and appellant pled guilty to it because you said she wasn't aware of the what the definition of values, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel claim raised at either the CCA or before this court. So I guess I'm with Chief of what does seem to be consistent is that appellant during the care inquiry and then after introducing the statement from the appraiser admitted to the value being greater than $1,000. So what are we to make, if anything, that no IAC claim was ever lodged?
A few things, Your Honor, but first and foremost, as this court stated in CARE, while defense counsel have an obligation to ensure that there is a factual basis for the plea and that the client understands what they're pleading guilty to, that does not relieve the military judge of that obligation on the record to ensure that their plea is provident. So that's the first point, Your Honor, that even though there's no ineffective assistance of counsel claim here, it doesn't matter. CARE, Article 45, and RCM 910 compel the result in this case that the plea should be set aside.
Now, you invoke Article 45. What about Article 45C, where we're talking about finding prejudice? Where do we find prejudice here?
In a few ways, Your Honor. I think there's two levels of prejudice here. The first is at her guilty plea level, and the second is what the Air Force Court did to that. So starting with the prejudice at her guilty plea, like I was discussing before about how value is complex in this case, value was in her understanding of what it meant and what she had to plead guilty to. It was tied. The government asserted in their brief that value is independent of the property, but that's not true. The value was tied to what she had to plead guilty to. So her understanding of the offense is the first problem and the first piece of prejudice. The second at the trial level goes to this double jeopardy idea as well, that without knowing what the value of the property was, she could have been recriminalized for pieces of property that she did not plead guilty to. That's how these are connected. The value is significant in this case by giving her notice of what she had to plead guilty to. And finally, severity at the trial level as well. Her understanding of this offense and what the military judge advised her of is that she stole $21,000 worth of jewelry. But in fact, that was not the value of the property legally. But that's what she was advised of, and that's what she was going to plead guilty to. But that's incorrect. The value of the property is much lower. And that difference between a $1,000 larceny, a $10,000 larceny, and $21,000 larceny is so quantitatively different that it is qualitatively different.
Now, how so? The military judge who is imposing the sentence, number one, there's no statutory difference whether it's more than $1,000 or $21,300. Plus, the military judge was very well aware of the fluidity of the amount, the value of the property. So where do we find prejudice there?
Your Honor, we disagree that the military judge was aware of the fluidity of the property because he still found that there was evidence in the record that the value was about $21,300. And that's what Sergeant Marin Perez pled guilty to, a $21,300 larceny. That's what she should have been sentenced on. And it's indicative also in the Air Force Court's analysis, and this goes to the second part or the second level of prejudice, that the Air Force Court also found as fact that the value of the jewelry under any scenario was, quote, substantially in excess of $1,000. But she, Sergeant Marin Perez, never agreed to that after the conflict arose. The Air Force Court was rather blatantly wrong or clearly erroneous in that fact-finding that she did plead guilty to something substantially over $1,000 when the conflict arose. So the military...
So during the second CARE inquiry, she did admit she was provident to more than $1,000. So your objection is the substantially more?
Yes and no, Your Honor. We disagree that it was provident to over $1,000 because she was not advised of what value meant in this case. It's like every single party.
So you keep on circling back to that. I just want to make sure I understand your point. It would seem that anyone in the armed forces would have the capacity to understand the meaning of the word value, particularly when it's attached to inanimate objects such as jewelry. So what is the point you're trying to make in terms of appellant here didn't know what value meant?
I think there's a difference between she understood it meant it was of some value and what the government charged. And the government charged a few different the way the government charged this case is what compels this result of setting aside the plea because it's improvident. So the way the value connects to the items, the way that the government chose to narrow the scope of this specification to a certain amount, as opposed to just alleging over $1,000, there wouldn't be a problem here if it was just over $1,000 and that's what it was in the specification. I would agree, Your Honor. That is something that every service member should understand. Just like in Barton, that was not a complex element for a service member to understand. But here, value is different. Value, just like in the AWOL cases, like in Pinero, increase the severity of the crime, not because of just the minimum maximum punishment delineation, but because a 53-day AWOL is significantly different than a 9-day AWOL. And just like in this case, a $21,300 larceny is significantly different than any lower value larceny. And Sergeant Marin Perez was not advised by the military judge what this conflict meant for her case. There were ways that this conflict could have been resolved on the record right then and there, but that did not happen. And instead, the military judge elicited a legal conclusion by simply asking, do you agree it's over $1,000? We can compare this in the record to when the military judge went through value the first time with Sergeant Marin Perez. She hedged the value. She didn't agree to $21,300. Instead, she agreed it was about $1,650, which, as I already brought up, was already conflicted on the record because of the pawn shop receipts. And in this initial dialogue, he asks her, do you agree that the individual who appraised the jewelry had knowledge, that he understood what the value was? And she said, yes. We don't have this same colloquy, this same interaction for a factual basis when the care is reopened later on in the proceeding on January.
I didn't want to steer you away from your other argument here involving the authority of the CCA to engage in exceptions and substitutions.
Yes, Your Honor. For what the Air Force Court did, and I think for both levels here at the trial level and the appellate level, there's a difference between identifying a problem and fixing it correctly. And neither the military judge fixed it correctly when he reopened the care, and the Air Force Court did not fix it correctly when they attempted to use exceptions and substitutions or narrow this specification consistent with care. This specification cannot be narrowed, and a lot of our discussion today has surrounded about what was the value of the property, why didn't she know what it was? And that's the problem here in this case as to why it can't be narrowed to an unconflicted factual basis in the record. There are ways that this case did not have to resolve this way, but that's not what we have here, and it also goes to the fact that there is no lesser-included offense available in this case. If we contrast this case to United States versus Simpson, there was specific intent for that individual to commit a larceny against a particular person, but there was factual impossibility, which prevented that larceny from actually occurring legally. We don't have that same situation here. Sergeant Marin Perez did not intend to steal $21,300 worth of jewelry. That's in the record. She did not know what the value of the property was when she stole it. It's discussed in her care inquiry. So there's no lesser included offense of attempt. And when we look at what lesser included offenses are under the elements test, value is not changing. Value remains an element between a lower valued larceny and a higher valued larceny.
Counsel, if we agree with you that the CC had no authority to affirm guilt by exception and substitution, what options did they have?
Your Honor, it wasn't by exceptions and substitutions. They can't use that, but they could use English's narrowing principle generally, and they can use lesser-included offenses generally to affirm a specification. However, we just don't have those options available in this case because of the record. But that doesn't mean that those two options aren't available in other guilty pleas or other larceny cases.
Did they have the option of affirming finding no prejudice under Article 45C?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because of those two levels of prejudice. There was prejudice, as this Court has found in all
But would that be Would that generally, not in this case, but generally in reviewing a guilty plea, could they find that there was some inconsistency that the military judge failed to resolve during the CARE inquiry, but then under 45C then hold that that inconsistency was harmless?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Hale, Haygood, and Taylor, the Scrivener's errors cases, represent that principle. Here we don't have the same kind of Scrivener's error that occurred. The government charged the value wrong. Sergeant Marin Perez was advised on the wrong value by the military. Well, she was advised on the value the government charged, but that turned out to be the wrong value legally. So that option is not available. What the Air Force Court did originally was consistent with Simpson in that there was a conflict, there was an error that the military judge failed to correct. There's just no way around this fact pattern to affirm the specification in a way that is valid. The last thing I'd like to discuss is that the Air Force Court exceeded its authority in a different way as well by using factual sufficiency analysis. And we can see that through the third sentence and the fourth sentence in their analysis, where they talk about a different definition for value and find that the value of the property was substantially in excess of $1,000. Under the new Article 66 and under English in general, this is not an option for the Air Force Court to do. The focus is on providency, not on sufficiency. And factual sufficiency, even under the new 66, is going to require the appellant to trigger it. Neither of those occur in this case because it's a guilty plea and because factual sufficiency doesn't apply in a guilty plea. But the Air Force Court went ahead and found these facts to affirm this conviction and exceeded its authority in this way. Ultimately, this case should stand for that English cannot apply to a guilty plea where the factual basis provided by the appellant conflicts in a way that reveals that he or she did not understand how the law relates to the facts. Unless there is a lesser included offense to affirm, a set aside is required. Barring any further questions, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Major Castanian.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Wright.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Donnell Wright, and along with Miss Mary Ellen Payne, represent the United States. There is one undisputed value in this record, and it is more than $1,000. Appellant admitted six times that the value of this property was more than $1,000. She now asks this court to ignore the factual predicate that she established, and this court should decline for three reasons. First, under Article 59B, this court is empowered to affirm a lesser-included offense when supported by the record. Second, the lower court appropriately narrowed the specification to the value that appellant admitted to twice under oath. Third, if this court finds that the lower court erred, the appropriate remedy is for this court to approve a lesser-included offense or remand to the lower court. Based on the undisputed value in this record, this court could approve a lesser-included offense of, specifically, more than $1,000, but less than $21,300. And it is appropriate for this court to do so because appellant admitted six times that the value of the property was more than $1,000, five times under oath. And even when she introduced doubt into the proceedings and when asked by the military judge to clarify, she not only affirmed, but then reaffirmed that the value of this property was more than $1,000.
Captain Wright, what about Major Castanian's point that with the pawn statement, that although the nine items added up to more than $1,000, she only pleaded to six of those items and therefore set up matter that was inconsistent with the plea?
Well, Your Honor, so the pawn shop receipts set a floor. Well, appellant's statement set a floor that she does believe and admit that the value of the property was more than $1,000. Then you have the pawn receipts. Then you have the ceiling of $21,300 established by the insurance appraisal. Yes, appellant did admit to six concrete items, but the lower court found that under any scenario, that property was substantially in excess of $1,000, and it based its finding on Part 4 of the Manual for Court Martial, 64C, which uses the common knowledge test, that if the property is objectively in excess of more, substantially in excess of more than $1,000, then the court martial may adjudge it so. Your Honor, we are dealing with more than 119 grams of gold, more than 186 individual diamonds totaling more than 9 carats. That property is objectively, substantially in excess of $1,000.
On that point, Captain Wright, then what's the point of pleading the exact amount of $21,000 if the only fact of consequence is that it has to be over $1,000? I mean, you may not know the answer to this question because you weren't down there at the trial. I understand that.
Charter.
But just out of curiosity, I mean, sometimes I don't ask legal questions. I'm just asking out of curiosity, what's the point? Why would you charge that amount if really the only significant point is that it be above $1,000?
Well,
I mean, you have the stipulation of fact. If you're, not you, but if the prosecutor was worried about making sure that this extraordinary amount made it into the record, it's in the record, and you could put it in the record through the stipulation of fact. So I guess I'm just curious, we're all sitting here. I mean, I'm not blaming you, but we're all sitting here, and I'm curious why we're sitting here. Like I say, you may not be able to answer the question, and if your answer to my question is, "Sir, I don't know, I'll find out,"
well, yes,
then,
Your Honor.
Then that's okay.
I will say yes, Your Honor. That is a very interesting question, and while the government was not required to here plead the specific amount, it was not fatal that it did plead a specific amount, particularly here. Where the maximum punishment for both the specific amount and the accepted amount and the substitute amount was the same, which exposed appellant to a maximum punishment of 5 years. But I would refer, Your Honor, to this court in United States versus Askew when it addressed a similar analogous case where this court affirmed a lower court's narrowing of a specification from more than of about $10,000 and accepted that language and then substituted the language for in excess of $100. A similar factual scenario here where we accepted the language of $21,300 and substituted the language of more than $1,000 here. And I will submit to you that if this court there could find no error in the language formulation and in excess of $100, then this court should not be offended here where the substituted language was more than $1,000. And of note, this court there, based in its ruling, emphasized that the maximum punishment was the same for both the accepted language and the substituted language. And it is the same factual scenario here where the maximum punishment is the same for both the accepted language of $21,300 and more than $1,300.
So that kind of leads me into the question of whether we're really dealing with a lesser included offense here. You've said throughout your argument here and in your brief that really in all of these instances, no matter how you slice and dice it, it is the offense was larceny in the amount of more than $1,000. So is it really a lesser included offense to say that it was more than $1,000 but less than $21,300?
I would say yes, Your Honor. But, it's a lesser included offense because it establishes a lower floor for the value.
But the elements are not different.
The elements are not correct, Your Honor. The elements are not different.
So I'm having a hard time grasping why, instead of saying it would be a narrowing, instead invoking the technical legal term of lesser included offense. Why is the government taking that approach.
Well, to Your Honor's point, instead of using the term of narrowing, I think it's important for us to note that under Article 59B, this Court is empowered to affirm a lesser-included offense. And it is appropriate for
What would the lesser-included offense be?
The lesser-included offense specifically would be more than 1,000 but less than 21,000.
Isn't that approach exactly what this Court rejected in English? Right? Because there, the government had specified a specific type of force, and it was decided that that wasn't proven. And the Court said, well, you can't just delete this specific and go back to just generally force, because that's not an LIO.
Well, Your Honor, I think in English what the Court primarily was concerned with there was the changing of the theory of the case and submitting a theory not presented to the fact finder.
And so, counsel, that was – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you
okay.
off. But that was the question I was going to get to that follows on to Chief's. Is this really a lesser-included offense, or is it the narrowing that English itself recognizes? In that – Well, I'll ask that question first. You can answer, then I have a follow-up.
Well, so answering your question, yes, what occurred here was a proper narrowing, as expressly preserved by the Court in English. The case was the same. The defense was the same. The elements were the same. Only the reduction in value was different. Here, we did not – the government did not change their theory. The government did not increase – the sentencing exposure of appellant. So what occurred was a permissible narrowing at the lower court, as expressly preserved by this Court in English, to narrow the scope of a conviction to conduct that it deemed legally and factually sufficient. But that still does not take away also from this Court's other ability to affirm what we also deem as a lesser-included offense.
Counsel, is the CCA's review in this case governed primarily by Article 45 or by Article 66? Because you may not be aware of this, but in the Army CCA and I believe in the Navy Marine Corps CCA, when they review guilty pleas, they really only apply Article 45, and they don't do full-blown factual sufficiency review under Article 66. Is the Air Force, I think, has taken a slightly different approach and will do both. Is it the government's view that this case should be primarily reviewed under Article 45 or Article 66, or do both apply equally? Do you have to get through both gates?
Your Honor, I would say both apply equally. 45 and Article 66, they operate in conjunction with each other. And here at the lower court, I believe they recited to Article 66, which was appropriate, but that Article 45 still applies, particularly whether there is a material prejudice under Article 45C. So they both apply and they operate in conjunction with each other.
And where did the CCA find the authority to affirm guilt by exception and substitution in this case?
Your Honor, they specifically referenced Article 66D, and I think using the term exceptions and substitutions is a term of art, and I think that may have been what kind of set this entire proceeding off. But it does not change the fact that what occurred here was an appropriate narrowing of the specification. The value was reduced from the stipulated charge value that appellant admitted to twice under oath, and she even admitted to the value of more than $1,000 twice under oath. So the lower court here appropriately narrowed the specification to the value that appellant admitted to twice under oath, and it was appropriate to do so here.
So does that mean there was no error, or does that mean there was no prejudice? What I'm asking is, say we think that there is no authority for the CCAs to affirm guilt by exception and substitution, and that was an error. Did your argument go to, well, that even if there was error under Article 45C, there's no prejudice?
Correct, Your Honor. If there is no error, then the next proper step would have been for, and I believe the lower court may have actually performed a prejudice analysis, except it was not explicit in, precisely explicit in the record, but it did indicate that it found the remedy that appellant requested, which was the setting aside of the findings and the sentence, as unwarranted. And so that could potentially mean that it did perform an Article 45C analysis. But if this court does find error, then it should have, the lower court should have proceeded with whether that analysis materially prejudiced the appellant. And I would argue to this court, there is no prejudice here. Appellant received the charge sheet. She reviewed the charge sheet with the advice of counsel. She then submitted a plea agreement with the advice of counsel. She then entered into a binding stipulation of fact with the advice of counsel. Paragraph 13 of the binding stipulation of fact. Both parties agree and admit that the statements are uncontradicted fact. Paragraph 14, the contents are true, and both parties voluntarily enter into this stipulation. And then we come to the care inquiry, where appellant admits under oath three times that the value of the property is more than $1,000. She then admits to the stipulated charge value of $21,300. And then again, when she introduces doubt into these proceedings and the military judge seeks clarification, she not only affirms, but she reaffirms the value of the property is more than $1,000. And her affirmations were unequivocal. Her statements must have value. Her signature on the binding stipulation of facts must have value. We must be able to take an appellant at his word.
Captain Wright, let me ask you this question. You've just kind of gone through the colloquy that took place there between the parties and the military judge. It raises the issue of waiver. I notice the government did not argue waiver in this case, but notwithstanding, suppose a majority of this court decides that this was waived, this issue of the guilty plea. Does the court then reach this other concern that the defense has raised about the CCA's authority about narrowing or taking exceptions and substitutions?
I would say,
have you thought on that?
I have given it some thought, Your Honor, and a very thoughtful.
I figured you have.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would say if this court decides that those issues were waived at the lower court, then you do not have to reach the decision of whether the lower court appropriately exercised its powers under Article 16.
And I'm not suggesting we will, but I just noticed, given the colloquy, that it certainly raises a question in one's mind, and maybe I'm the only one, I don't know, but maybe in one's mind, that the issue of waiver might be alive and well. Thank you, though.
Yes, Your Honor. Proceeding to my second point, the exercise of power by the lower court here is a routine power generally exercised by the lower courts and has been affirmed by this court as far back as 1985 in United States versus O'Neill, where this court affirmed a lower court's narrowing of a specification, where it accepted multiple words and then substituted a specific value for a higher specific value. And I submit to this court here that if what occurred there was a permissible narrowing where the substituted value was actually increased, then it certainly should not offend the court. And what occurred here was also a permissible narrowing where the substituted value was decreased. What occurred here, the lower court determined that under any factual scenario, the value of the property was substantially in excess of $1,000. There is one undisputed value in this record. It has been affirmed and it is reaffirmed, and it is that the value of this property was more than $1,000. And you have appellant's own words. I do believe and admit that Ms. NM's jewelry is a greater value of $1,000. That is an unequivocal statement that has value and that this court should not ignore. Any further questions?
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, Captain Wright, if you want to briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. To find for this appellant, this court would have to ignore her repeated sworn admissions. And the Air Force Court here properly exercises Article 66 authority. There was no prejudice here and no error here. And for these reasons, we respectfully ask that this court affirm the lower court's findings. Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Castaigne.
Judge Sparks, we're here today because this court has held for over 60 years that the protections of CARE, Article 45, and RCM 910, when combined, cannot be waived. And what happened in this case is that there was a conflict that appeared in the record that the military judge did not reconcile. It was as though all the players in this case were not on the same sheet of music for what value meant. And even the government today came up and said she stole X amount of gold and X amount of diamonds, as though Sergeant Marin Perez stole the crown jewels. She did not, and she was never advised on what value meant in her case in a way that this court or the Air Force Court could affirm an unconflicted, voluntary plea. And that's what this case comes down to. Judge Hardy, some of your questions targeted the issue of sufficiency and prejudice. In Faircloth, this court held that for a guilty plea, the issue is providence, not sufficiency of the evidence. And that's why askew is not applicable here. While I looked for procedural history on that case, I could not find it. So all we have is the plain text of what askew provides, and it talks about sufficiency. Sufficiency is not the correct standard of review. English and Article 66D are founded in sufficiency and could be a tool for narrowing a specification. But we just don't have the ability to narrow the specification in this case in a way that makes the plea voluntary and unconflicted. So askew is not relevant and is not applicable in this case. The focus is on providence and those two tiers of prejudice. First, Article 45. Yes, the Air Force Court already found and the government did not cross appeal on the issue that Sergeant Marin Perez's plea was not voluntary or provident as to the specification that was drafted. That second tier is what the Air Force Court did after, the prejudice of the Air Force Court using exceptions and substitutions, which is not a proper tool. Yes, the Air Force Court could narrow, it could use Article 45C, and it could find a lesser included offense. But none of these three options are available in this case. Instead, the Air Force Court broadened the specification. As Your Honor noted, Judge Hardy, with English, that's exactly what happened here. The specification was broadened from a generic, from a specific value to a generic value that could go up to $1 million. And while that's not in the record, that's not clear from the specification when it's rewritten. When someone looks at what Sergeant Marin Perez did, it's over $1,000. And that has a tendency to overstate her criminality. That's the first step of prejudice here for what the Air Force Court did.
But this, counsel, I know you're about to run out of time, but on that narrow broad, has in determining whether a court has properly narrowed or broadened it, hasn't this court consistently looked to the nature, the theory of the case, and whether that was somehow affected by the CCA's action?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Please respond to Judge Johnson's question.
Yes, Your Honor, that is part of it. And here how that ties into a guilty plea is that Sergeant Marin Perez was not provided the necessary necessary definition for value to make that connection valid in this case. So, for example, in Barton, there was enough guidance or advice from the military judge to the appellant that the conspiracy specification could be used to affirm the larceny conviction. We don't have that similar cross-advisement on the record to be able to narrow that on a theory of liability. Rather, Sergeant Marin Perez understood and provided a legal conclusion for it being over $1,000, but as already pointed out, there's conflict on this value throughout the record. And even today, as both parties stand here, we're not sure what the value of the record remains. So this court should set aside the findings in the sentence.
Any further questions? You may briefly conclude.
Your Honor, there's a difference between identifying a problem and fixing it correctly. Because the Air Force Court did not fix the providence of Sergeant Marin Perez's guilty plea, this court should set aside the findings and sentence because there's no lesser included offense to affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:20.
All rise.
Court stands in recess until 10:20.